He seemed to have it all. A young man, superstar athlete, and a promising career in the NFL. Then friends and family would slowly start to notice that something was different about Aaron. Something that no one could predict or put a finger on until tragedy struck. Murder. Today, the rise and fall of NFL superstar Aaron Hernandez on the dark side of Wikipedia.
Sometimes the human mind goes to dark places. Sometimes those dark delusions turn into a reality. A reality so shaded and gray, once all is said and done, the healthy mind is drawn into the documented retelling of these tragic events, trying to find logic, reason, and understanding where there may be none at all. This is the dark side of Wikipedia.
Aaron Joseph Hernandez was an American football tight end and convicted murderer. He played in the NFL for 3 seasons with the New England Patriots until his career came to an abrupt end after his arrest and conviction for the murder of Odin Lloyd. An All-American at the University of Florida, Hernandez was drafted by the Patriots in the 4th round of the 2010 NFL draft alongside teammate Rob Gronkowski. He formed one of the league's most dominant tight end duos, becoming the first pair of tight ends to score at least 5 touchdowns each in consecutive seasons with the same team. He made 1 Super Bowl appearance in Super Bowl XLVI. During the 2013 offseason, Hernandez was arrested and charged for the murder of Odin Lloyd, a semi-professional player who was dating the sister of Hernandez's fiance. Following his arrest, Hernandez was immediately released by the Patriots. He was found guilty of first-degree murder in 2015 and sentenced to serve life in prison without the possibility of parole for the Sousa Brunowski Correctional Center. While on trial for Lloyd's murder, he was also indicted for the 2012 double homicide of Daniel Deabro and Safiro Furtado, who was acquitted after a 2017 trial. Days after being acquitted of the double homicide, Hernandez was found dead in his cell, which was ruled a suicide. His conviction for Lloyd's murder was initially vacated under the doctrine of abatement, because Hernandez died during its appeal, but was reinstated in 2019 following an appeal from prosecutors and Lloyd's family. Hernandez was posthumously diagnosed with chronic traumatic encephalopathy, CTE, which has led to speculation over how the condition may have affected his behavior. Well, it is the dark side of Wikipedia, and this is certainly an interesting case. Tony and Sean joining you on today's episode. I've been watching a docuseries about this whole case. I didn't realize he died until I just read that he killed himself.
Really?
No, I haven't followed it very much. I mean, I've just, you know, bits and pieces here and there when it was more active, but I didn't realize that he had killed himself in prison. But gosh, I mean, this is a very bizarre character, you know, from the get-go. What's your thoughts on the case and what's your knowledge of it?
Yeah, to my recollection, first time I heard of it was watching ESPN and SportsCenter, and all of a sudden there's cameras set outside Aaron Hernandez's house, and then it just kind of gains momentum. There's word that he apparently killed someone, and then how can somebody so talented be on? Because whether you're a sports fan or not, the New England Patriots, the football team that Aaron Hernandez was on, they're like the Yankees in baseball. They are the top of the National Football League. So they are talented. They are good. They win Super Bowls. And to know that this guy was obviously very athletically gifted, but nobody knew of his other life, that he killed one person, killed multiple people.
Yeah. It was certainly a messed up life that he lived. And just, you know, listening to him in his conversations that were recorded during this time and when he was in prison and even before. Have you heard him at all? Like his voice with the things that he was saying and the way he would talk? I mean, he had the mentality of probably an 11-year-old. And probably the vocabulary skills of an 11-year-old and just the emotional regulation of an 11-year-old, if not younger.
Yes, I think similarly to you not knowing he died until just now. Bits and pieces of hearing audio recordings, but I mean, you don't want to have the stereotype of a dumb jock, if you will, where you're very physically talented, but not so much book smart. The real question is, what's very interesting is this specific gentleman, is he just kind of dumb? Which I'm not knocking on dumb people. Some people just are not, they're yeah. dumb. Or is this years and years and years of being hit in the head when your job is essentially to catch a ball and then everybody tries to tackle large, grown, muscle-bound fellas try to tackle you? Do you then lose a little bit of mental capacity with that? Or yeah. you're not smart, and then you play football for 20 years.
I think that's more in line of, we're probably talking about someone with a very low IQ and probably abuse and probably, you know, things that he needed help for. And then you add all the NFL, you know, trauma to that as far as the hitting and all of that. And someone with a propensity to get angry and not be able to regulate their emotions and then seeks violence because the only way to act them out, because that's what he would do. And you essentially have a violent, mentally ill 11-year-old in an adult's body with access to money and weapons. And this is what happens.
What could possibly go wrong?
And that's what you have. I mean, I think that's really, you know, kind of the summary of his story. You know, had there been mental health help, had he wanted to get help, had he been given help, had he been forced to get help, I don't think he'd be in this show. You know, but that's our world today, though, with mental health. It has to be the person who needs the help has to want it and has to choose to get it. And there's very little outside forces can do to force that. I mean, the everything is really stacked in the corner of the individuals who need the help to make the decision of continuing that help, unless we're talking quite extreme situations. And you know, the quite extreme situations are the ones that, yes, clearly most times are in facilities or are very restrained from having that sort of stuff. But it's these where they're kind of on the edge of, this person really shouldn't be in this sort of place or have access to these sort of things. They play football really good and they're doing really good for this team, and then they get all the money, and then they still have all these anger problems, but they have access to the weapons and nobody can stop them because they haven't done anything yet. And even when they have done things, they still can get access to that sort of shit. I mean, it's a real fucked up system we have that does not work in the favor of truly helping these people get better. It works.
Very interesting.
It very much works in the favor of, what do they feel like doing today?
We are recording this the last few days of 2020, and I am here in Middle Tennessee. Christmas Day morning, a bomb went off downtown, an RV, a gentleman who was having some troubles in the mental capacity last August, so August of 2019, his then girlfriend, which whenever we talk about these serial killers and very deranged people, even they have wives, even they have girlfriends, as I talk single. There was a report, the girlfriend said, that he was making bombs in this RV. The police went over, they could not enter his property, and he had done nothing wrong prior. So thank God nobody was killed in this Nashville bombing situation. But to your point, it's a situation where if you're not a chronic offender or you don't have a rap sheet, there are laws in place that one cannot do anything. And it's one thing if you're walking down the side of the road, your arm is spewing blood. Somebody's going to stop and they're going to get you into a car, call an ambulance, get you into the emergency room. But all too often, if you see somebody talking to themselves or pacing back and forth on that same sidewalk, nobody can do a darn thing.
No.
Because unless they want that help, you're not going to shackle them. You're not going to put a jacket on them and tie them to a chair it is very unfortunate that the situation right now of people that need help and that are not even able to make conscious decisions they're the only ones that can make the decision.
Yeah.
It almost seems completely opposite of what it should be.
It is. It gets, 'cause it is completely opposite of what it should be. And that's what's so fucked up about our country and how we deal with these sort of things. It's counterintuitive to any sort of rationality. Anyway, let's continue on with the story of Aaron Hernandez and jump into his family story and abuse, which you put the pieces together, like I said, it makes a very sad, troubled individual that went down a horrible path where I think there was many ways, had mental health help been available readily, wouldn't have to have gone that direction. Aaron Joseph Hernandez was born in Bristol, Connecticut, and raised on Greystone Avenue. He was the son of Dennis Hernandez, of Puerto Rican descent, and Terry Valentine Hernandez, of Italian descent. As an adult, Hernandez remembered his mother throwing his father out of the house on multiple occasions, but always letting him back in. The couple married in 1986 and divorced in 1991 and remarried in 1996. In 1991, they filed for bankruptcy. Hernandez would later state there was constant fighting going on in the home. Both parents would be arrested and involved in crimes during their lives. Hernandez had an older brother, Dennis Jonathan Jr., known as DJ. Their father pushed them to excel, including through sports, but was often abusive towards both the boys and their mother. The beatings Hernandez's father gave him and his brother were sometimes for no reason at all or were alcohol-related, but often came when their father believed they were not trying hard enough in school or athletics. DJ and Hernandez lived in constant fear of their father, but also revered him. Hernandez once came to school with a black eye that his coach believed resulted from his father hitting him. His father once punched Hernandez's youth football coach after a dispute about coaching methods. Publicly, their father projected an image of someone who had some run-ins with police, but turned his life around to become a good father and citizen. In January 2006, when Hernandez was 16, Dennis died from complications from hernia surgery. According to his mother, Hernandez was greatly affected by his father's death, and he acted out of his grief by rebelling against authority figures. Those who knew him said he never got over his father's death. Hernandez became estranged from his mother and largely moved in with Tanya Singleton, his older cousin, following Dennis's death. The family learned that Terry Hernandez and Singleton's husband, Jeff Cummings, had been having an external affair. After the affair became public, Singleton and Cummings divorced, and Cummings moved in with Terry. This enraged Hernandez. It was while he was living with Singleton that Hernandez became more involved in criminal activity. In a jailhouse conversation, Hernandez accused his mother, Terry, of failing to obtain medication for his attention deficit disorder, which he said caused him to struggle in school. In another call, he told her, "There's so many things I'd love to talk to you about so you can know me as a person, but I never could tell you, and you're going to die without even knowing your son." According to Hernandez's brother, DJ, Hernandez was also sexually molested as a child. A teenage boy in his babysitter's house forced Hernandez to perform oral sex on him, beginning when Hernandez was 6 years old and continued for several years. Hernandez attended Bristol Central High School, where he played for the Bristol Rams football team. He was also an exceptional basketball player and track runner. He started as a wide receiver before becoming a tight end and also played defensive end. As a senior, he was Connecticut's Gatorade Football Player of the Year after making 67 receptions for 1,807 yards and 24 touchdowns on offense and 72 tackles, 12 sacks, 3 forced fumbles, 2 fumble recoveries, and 4 block kicks on defense. He was also a U.S. Army All-American. The 1,807 receiving yards and 24 touchdowns were state records. Hernandez's 31 career touchdowns tied the state record. He also set the state record for receiving yards in a single game of 376, the 7th best in national high school history. He set a national high school record for yards receiving per game with 180.7. Hernandez was considered the top tight end recruit in 2007 by Scout.com. He was not known for working hard as a child, but by high school, when he was nearly 6'2" tall, he worked harder than anyone else on the team. During one game in 2006, Hernandez took a blindside hit to the head so hard that he was knocked out cold. An ambulance had to take him off the field. Hernandez was popular in school. He first began dating his future fiance, Shanna Jenkins, during high school. The two had known each other since elementary school. He also smoked a large quantity of marijuana, smoking before school, practices, and games. His social life included a sizable amount of drinking in addition to the marijuana. On January 6, 2010, Hernandez announced his decision to forgo his remaining eligibility and enter the 2010 NFL Draft. He attended the NFL scouting combine but was unable to perform any physical drills after tearing a muscle in his back during the offseason. On March 17, 2010, Hernandez participated at Florida's Pro Day and performed all of the combine drills. His time in the 40-yard dash would have ranked fourth among all tight ends at the NFL combine. Hernandez also performed 30 repetitions of 225 pounds on the bench press and would have been at the top performance of all tight ends, surpassing Dennis Pitta's top performance of 27 repetitions. NFL analyst Mike Mayock stated that off-the-field concerns and concerns over Hernandez's physical size were hurting his draft stock, but believed Hernandez would still be drafted in the second round. At the conclusion of the pre-draft process, he was projected to be a second-round pick by the majority of NFL draft experts and scouts. He was ranked as the third best tight end prospect in the draft by Bleacher Report, was ranked the fourth best tight end by Mayock, and was ranked the fifth best tight end by DraftScout.com. Hernandez was not popular with his fellow Patriots and had few friends in the locker room. Brady was overheard after a game telling Tim Tebow, Hernandez's quarterback in college, that he was trying to steer Hernandez in the right direction but called him a lot to handle. Tebow had previously tried to help Hernandez and listed Brady for some purpose. Hernandez was, however, known as one of the hardest-working members of the team. Other Patriots said that Hernandez was often seeking attention and at times seemed unhinged. Belichick was running out of patience with Hernandez by June of 2013 and threatened to throw him off the team. After his arrest for the murder of Odin Lloyd, Belichick prohibited Hernandez's name from being spoken in the locker room. Gronkowski repeatedly declined to answer any questions about Hernandez in interviews and nearly walked out during a CBS interview in 2013 until the reporter agreed to change the subject away from his former teammate. One of his letters sent from his time in prison, Hernandez disparaged Kraft as fake-ass non-loyal but expressed admiration for several of his teammates. He was the closest with Brady, he said, and also friendly with Julian Edelman and Deion Branch. He also called Gronkowski the best TE ever to walk the football field. Hernandez had a number of run-ins with police throughout his life, beginning just a few months after he arrived in Florida as a pre-freshman. By his own admission, Hernandez became jumpy at nightclubs and had a history of taking offense at minor slights. He also said that he believed people were trying to physically challenge him and were looking to fight him. Acquaintances describe Hernandez as a follower who put himself in jeopardy by hanging out with dangerous crowds. As a Patriot, Hernandez hired two of his friends from Bristol, both of whom had criminal records as assistants. One of them, Alexander S. Bradley, was a drug dealer. As Hernandez's assistant, Bradley's other duties including calming Hernandez down during fits of rage and paranoia and obtaining weapons for him. After his death, his high school teammate and lover said that being drafted by the Patriots was the worst thing the NFL could have done because it put him back in close proximity to the criminal friends he had in Connecticut. Hernandez kept a second apartment a secret from his fiancée, Shanna Jenkins, and used it to store drugs and weapons. He'd often go there to chain smoke marijuana. In 2012, Hernandez told his agents that he got his respect through weapons. Boston police detectives once questioned Hernandez outside of a local bar, but the circumstances around the interview are unclear. On April 8, 2007, according to a police report in Gainesville, Florida, 17-year-old Hernandez consumed two alcoholic drinks in a restaurant with Tim Tebow, refused to pay the bill, and was escorted out of the restaurant by an employee. As the manager walked away, Hernandez sucker-punched him on the side of the head, rupturing his eardrum. The police responded at 1:17 a.m. Hernandez called coach Urban Meyer, and Meyer called Huntley Johnson, the team's unofficial defense lawyer. The victim later told police that he had been contacted by lawyers and the team and that a settlement was being worked out, something the team denied. The police department recommended charging Hernandez with felony battery, but the incident was settled out of court with a deferred prosecution agreement. On September 30, 2007, someone approached a car containing Randall Carson, Justin Glass, and Corey Smith on foot and fired five shots while they were waiting in Gainesville traffic after having left a nightclub. Smith was shot in the back of the head and Glass was shot in the arm. Both men survived. Carson, a backseat passenger, was uninjured and told police that the shooter was a Hawaiian or Hispanic male with a large build, weighing about 230 pounds and having many tattoos. He picked a photo of Hernandez out of a police lineup. The police told Meyer's personal assistant that they wanted to see Hernandez and two teammates immediately. Detectives kept pushing coaches to bring the players to the station, but they did not arrive for 4 hours. In the interim, the players spoke to Johnson, the attorney who often represented players. The other players cooperated with police, but Hernandez invoked his right to counsel and refused to talk to police. When police walked into the room to speak to Hernandez, The last of the players to be interviewed, they found him with his head down on the table and sleeping, a posture they said was unusual for someone in the middle of a homicide investigation. No charges were filed at the time due to his 2013 arrest and subsequent conviction for the murder of Odin Lloyd. Massachusetts authorities contacted police in Florida to try to determine whether Hernandez may have had a role in the 2007 shooting. Detective Tom Mullins, who was assigned to reinvestigate the shooting, concluded that Hernandez was not the trigger man. Although Carson initially identified Hernandez as such, other witnesses that might describe the shooter as looking like a black male, possibly with cornrows. While Mullins re-interviewed Carson, Carson rescinded his statement of the shooter matching Hernandez and said he never saw Hernandez at the scene, but assumed he was the shooter because they had words earlier at the club. At 3:45 a.m. on April 30th, 2011, police responded to a fight in front of Hernandez's rented townhouse in Plainville, Massachusetts. A high school friend had been pulled over earlier in the evening after driving Hernandez home from a Boston bar. The driver was weaving in and out of the lanes and traveling at 120 miles per hour in a work zone and on a highway with a speed limit of 55 miles per hour. The Massachusetts State Trooper who pulled the car over did not arrest the driver because he recognized Hernandez in the passenger seat. The Plainville police also recognized Hernandez and told the two to go indoors. Hernandez was investigated in connection with a double homicide that took place on July 16, 2012, near the Cure Lounge in Boston South End. Daniel George Corella Diabreu, 29, and Sofia Texia Furatu, 28, both immigrants from Cape Verde and living in Dorchester, were killed by gunshots fired into their vehicle. Witnesses testified that Hernandez's silver SUV pulled up next to the victims, and someone from his car window yelled, "What's up now?" Someone from the car then fired five shots, killing the two immigrants. Police immediately identified Hernandez, who was then playing for the Patriots, in the club's security camera footage, but thought it was a coincidence that the NFL star happened to be at the club that evening. On May 15th, 2014, Hernandez was indicted on murder charges for the killings of Abreu and Furtado, with additional charges of armed assault and attempted murder associated with the shots fired at the surviving occupants in the vehicle. The trial began March 1st, 2017. The prosecution case was strongly based on testimony by Bradley, a known drug dealer who had been feuding with Hernandez since the NFL player allegedly shot him in the face and left him to die. Hernandez and Bradley each claimed the other person pulled the trigger. Jose Baez, Hernandez's attorney, argued that the proposed motive was implausible and Hernandez was a suspect of convenience to close two unsolved murders. Bradley alleged that Hernandez was angered after the victim spilled a drink on him in a nightclub several hours before the shooting and killed him in retaliation. Security camera footage confirmed Hernandez was in the club for less than 10 minutes, and that time he calmly posed for a photo with a fan and left by himself, contradicting Bradley's testimony that he departed with Hernandez. Furthermore, Baez characterized the police investigation as extraordinarily sloppy. The victim's bodies were kept in their bullet-riddled vehicle as it was towed away from the shooting scene, a major protocol with no physical evidence tying Hernandez to the murders. According to the Boston Globe, there's powerful evidence that was the scene and played a role in their deaths. On April 14, 2017, Hernandez was acquitted of the murders and most of the other charges, but found guilty of illegal possession of a handgun. So let's take a moment to pause there and kind of get through some of that material of everything that went down. You know, someone who, you know, you look at it from afar and go, this guy's, you know, he's got everything. He's got all the money. He's got a house. He's got a wife. He's got a child. And he has a wonderful career going on and is incredibly talented. But he can't mentally handle any of that and ends up, you know, reverting to these very, you know, just crazy ways of operating, very reactionary to everything because he's not mentally capable of being an adult.
And I think it goes back to his dad would treat his mom so terrible, but then his mom would always give his dad a second, third, fourth, 24th chance. Yeah. So from a very young age, well, I can act out, I could do terrible things or lose my temper, but I'll still get that love. I'll still get that affection. I'll still be good to go. And then, oh yeah, by the way, when you are having a drink when you're 17, and then your future college coach kind of makes a call, okay, let's make this go away. Again, so I'm not insinuating that there were other people in Aaron Hernandez's life that led him to murder multiple people, but he didn't necessarily learn in multiple times in his life, if you do something wrong, you have to be held accountable.
Yeah. And that's where the disconnect comes in. I think he felt that he was above all of it. And when you get that sort of power and that money behind you and that ego and everybody kind of bowing down to you to do whatever you want, they lose that. And that's something that once that's lost, it's a difficult thing, I think, to get back the accountability factor in life, to realize I have to be accountable for my actions without something extremely tragic happening first.
And I think the big thing is all of us understand that there is a certain amount of accountability. We do something wrong at work. We get fired. You know, you don't pay your rent, you don't pay your mortgage, you lose your house. I think there's some pretty easy examples of accountability that you just have to have as an adult. But there's a lot of other things. There's so much gray area that, you know, taking the path of least resistance think back to when you were in school. If you don't like social studies, if you don't like science, you just, well, I'm not going to study for that. I don't like it. And then if you have the ability to get over it or to get a passing grade on something you don't like, you just move along. So you fast forward that into life. And if you can essentially get away with anything and everything, and you almost become addicted to it, well, I'm not going to take accountability. I mean, that's hard. That's not fun. And that is very difficult to then kind of get over that personal hump and to start taking accountability, short of being forced to do it. And if you can become a NFL football player, make millions of dollars that you never had to take accountability, well, then why the hell would you start?
Yeah. If no one's forcing you to do it. Yeah. I mean, it just ends up, he ends up behind bars, you know, literally for the rest of his life until he took his own life. And that's how that ends, because it's almost like you may have learned it once, but if it's unlearned, I don't know that it's necessarily always relearnable. It probably depends on the capabilities of the individual. But I think in many cases where things get like this, there's, you know, it's one of those things where you're learning as a child and your brain's developing as a child. And once you get to be an adult, you know, you can still learn, certainly, but the developmental stages, this is connecting to that and this is how that works. If that's not there, then yes, it becomes a learned behavior, but it's not like instinctual. And I think accountability in the well-functioning adult is instinctual. And in the non-well-functioning, it has to be a learned behavior. And then sometimes that gets fucked up, where they have to go, oh, wait, I gotta understand I'm going to be accountable. It's not just like that wall is there. It's like there's a note that says a wall should be here, but it's not. So you got to play by that there's a fake wall here and we'll pretend it's there, but it's easy to miss that sometimes. And then you get this. You get an individual that turns out this way. Let's continue into the story about Aaron Hernandez. In January 2013, Hernandez and Bradley partied at Cure again. At 2:20 a.m., Bradley was pulled over at the Southeast Expressway doing 105 miles an hour. According to state police, he was wobbly drunk. Hernandez tried to get his friend out of trouble by saying, "Trooper, I'm Aaron Hernandez. It's okay." However, Bradley was still arrested for drunk driving. 2013, Miami shooting of Alexander Bradley. In February of 2013, Hernandez, Bradley, and several others visited a Florida strip club where they rang up a $10,000 bill. Hernandez began to worry about two men sitting across from them, thinking they were plainclothes Boston police officers. Bradley later recalled telling Hernandez they were probably tracking the pair as part of their investigation into a double murder outside of the Cure. Hernandez and Bradley had a troubled relationship at this point. Bradley claimed that on February 13, 2013, during the same trip, he woke up in a car with Hernandez pointing a gun at his face. The next morning, police found Bradley lying in a parking lot and bleeding from a bullet hole between his eyes. Bradley survived, but lost his right eye. He did not cooperate with police, but instead sought revenge. The pair would trade more than 500 text messages in the next 3 months, which included death threats and attempts of extortion. Bradley told Hernandez that he had semi-automatic weapons, bulletproof vests, and a crew that ran six deep. Hernandez's agent tried unsuccessfully to settle the matter quietly. Bradley demanded $5 million to keep his silence, and Hernandez countered with $1.5 million. Bradley then asked for $2.5 million. Hernandez did not respond, but instead went to see his lawyer. On June 13, 2013, Bradley filed a civil lawsuit for damages against Hernandez in a Florida federal court. He withdrew the suit for 4 days later, giving the two a chance to work out a settlement without the media knowing about it. On September 3, 2013, Hernandez's lawyers filed a postponement request in federal court until his murder charges were resolved. In February of 2016, Hernandez reached a settlement with Bradley over the lawsuit. The terms of the settlement were not disclosed. On May 11, 2015, Hernandez was indicted for witness intimidation and retaliation to the Bradley shooting, since Bradley was reported a witness in the 2012 Boston double homicide. The intimidation charge for Hernandez carried a maximum penalty of 10 years in prison. This charge was included in Hernandez's trial for the double homicide, which began on March 1, 2017. During the trial, it was revealed Bradley texted his lawyer this about the shooting in a deleted text message. "Now, you sure once I withdraw this lawsuit, I won't be held on perjury after I tell the truth about me not recalling anything about who shot me?" Hernandez was later acquitted of the charge of witness intimidation by a jury on April 14, 2017. They also acquitted Hernandez of all other charges in the murders of D'Abreu and Furtado, except for finding him guilty of one count of illegal possession of firearms. Hernandez traveled to California with Jenkins and their younger daughter in 2013 to have shoulder surgery. While there, Jenkins called the police twice in less than a week, claiming that Hernandez was drunk and violent. In the first incident, Hernandez put his hand through a window. Hernandez's brother and friends later said that there were drugs and guns in the rented apartment, but police determined that Jenkins and the child were not in danger and never searched the premises. DJ found Hernandez alone on the roof of the building one night, looking defeated and rubbing the barrel of a gun against his face. On June 18, 2013, police searched Hernandez's home in connection with an investigation into the shooting death of a friend, Odin Lloyd, whose body was found with multiple gunshot wounds to the back and chest, in an industrial park about a mile from Hernandez's house. The following day, Hernandez assured Patriots coach Bill Belichick and owner Robert Kraft that he had nothing to do with the shooting. Despite this, Hernandez was barred from Gillette Stadium, lest it become the site of a media stakeout. The team also decided a week before his eventual arrest to cut ties with Hernandez if he was arrested on any charge related to the case. Hernandez was charged with first-degree murder, in addition to a 5-gun-related charges. The Patriots released Hernandez from the team about 90 minutes later before officially learning the charges against him. Two other men were also arrested in connection with Lloyd's death. Hernandez was indicted by a grand jury for the murder of Lloyd. He pled not guilty on September 6, 2013. On April 15, 2015, he was found guilty of murder in the first degree, a charge that in Massachusetts automatically carries a sentence of life in prison without the possibility of parole. He also was found guilty of 5 firearm charges. A motive for the murder was never definitively established. Police investigated the possibility that Lloyd may have learned of Hernandez's bisexuality, that Hernandez was worried that Lloyd might out him to others. Hernandez's arrest and subsequent termination by the Patriots resulted in financial and other consequences. He automatically forfeited his 2015 to 18 salaries, totaling $19.3 million, which were not guaranteed. The Patriots voided all remaining guarantees, including his 2013 and 2014 salaries, on the grounds that those guarantees were for skill, injury, or salary cap room and did not include being cut for conduct detrimental to the best interest of the professional football. The team planned to withhold $3.25 million of Hernandez's 2012 signing bonus that was due to be paid in 2014 and to recoup the signing bonus already paid. Within hours of Hernandez's arrest, the team's official pro shop at Patriot Place removed all his memorabilia and merchandise and removed these items from the website as well. The Patriots pro shop exchanged about 2,500 previously sold Hernandez jerseys for other jerseys, destroying and recycling the Hernandez jerseys for a loss of about $250,000. The NFL salary cap allows teams to prorate signing bonuses over the life of a contract or a 5-year period, whichever is shorter. By cutting Hernandez, the Patriots accelerated all of Hernandez's remaining guaranteed money into 2013 and 2014 salary caps. The team took a $2.55 million hit in 2013 and another $7.5 million in 2014. Since Hernandez had not completed his fourth season in the league, the Patriots were required to place him on waivers after releasing him. He went unclaimed. After Hernandez cleared waivers on June 28th, NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell announced that while charges against Hernandez were pending, the NFL would not approve any contract signed by Hernandez until Goodell held a hearing to determine whether Hernandez should face suspension or other actions under the league's personal conduct policy. In prison phone calls, Hernandez expressed distress at the treatment by Belichick and the Patriots. Kaito Sport and Puma canceled their endorsement deals with Hernandez. EA Sports announced that Hernandez's likeness would be dropped from its NCAA Football 14 and Madden NFL 25 video games. After visitor complaints, a prize-winning photo of Hernandez from his rookie season depicting him triumphantly high-stepping it into the end zone in front of the Green Bay Packers cornerback Sam Shields was removed from the Pro Football Hall of Fame. Panini America, a sports memorabilia and trading card company, removed stickers of Hernandez from approximately 500,000 sticker books that had not yet been sent to collectors. The company replaced the stickers as well as trading cards with cards depicting Tim Tebow. The University of Florida removed Hernandez's name and likeness from various locations at its football facilities, including a stone that has its name and All-American inscribed upon it. Bristol Central High School also removed all its awards and gave them to his family. Pop Warner removed his name from a list of award recipients. Hernandez gave power of attorney to his agent and instructed him to provide his fiancée with $3,000 a month to help her find more affordable housing. He also set aside $500,000 for his fiancée and their daughter and $120,000 for a close friend. After his arrest, his vacant house fell into extreme disrepair, including suffering burst pipes and mold. After Hernandez's death on April 25, 2017, his lawyers filed a motion at Massachusetts Superior Court in Fall River to vacate his murder conviction. The request was granted May 9, 2017. Therefore, Hernandez technically died an innocent man due to the legal principle of abatement ab initio. Under Massachusetts law, the principle asserts that when a criminal defendant dies but has not exhausted all legal appeals, the case reverts it to its status at the beginning. The conviction is vacated and the defendant is rendered innocent. At the time of his death, Hernandez was in the process of filing an appeal for his 2015 conviction and the murder of Odin Lloyd. As of May 9, 2017, the date of the judge's ruling to vacate, the Bristol County District Attorneys stated they planned to appeal the ruling to the Massachusetts Supreme Court if necessary. The Lloyd family was disappointed with the ruling, but their attorney did not believe it would affect the wrongful death civil suit which the family had filed. The appeal was heard by the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court in November of 2018, a year after Hernandez's death, by six justices. The attorney representing the Lloyd family, Thomas M. Quinn III, argued that Hernandez was rightfully convicted of Lloyd's murder and that the conviction was unfairly wiped out. Quinn also argued that Hernandez killed himself knowing of the technicality that would get his conviction thrown out and that he should not be able to accomplish in death what he never would have been able to do in life. On March 13, 2019, the Supreme Judicial Court reinstated Hernandez's conviction, but stated that the trial record would note that his conviction was neither affirmed nor reversed. The appeal was rendered moot because Hernandez died while the case was on appeal. The court, in their ruling, also officially ended the practice of abatement ab initio, ruling that it was outdated, never made sense, and that it was no longer consistent with the circumstances of contemporary life, if in fact it ever was. After the ruling, Hernandez's estate vowed to appeal the ruling further. Yeah, I'd say that's a fucking crazy law that we have there, where you're convicted, you're tried, you're found guilty, but if you want to try and appeal that in some way, shape, or form, and you die in that appeals process, it wipes out the conviction and goes back to you're innocent? What the fuck is that? You there?
I was so shocked that I forgot the mute button.
Yeah.
Son of a bitch. I don't understand that. The only thing I can think of is during an appeal, clearly there's appealing going on, so both sides need to be present to be able to go through everything, and the fact that you are not alive, it resets itself. I'm not sure. In the case that you can't defend yourself or be represented because you're dead.
But you were already found guilty once. I could understand it if there was no trial, if there was nothing and there was no verdict ever reached on your case. Then I guess you could say, you know.
Or there was a mistrial or there was just, we have to reconvene.
But we've already sentenced you to life in prison. Now, can you appeal that? Can you find different ways of doing that? I guess so. But you already had that verdict rendered to you once. That doesn't make it moot. It's that's just one of the many fucked up things in our system that makes little to no sense. That, I mean, it plays to the advantage of the criminal. I mean, it's so fucked up.
I believe there was a song. Is it Salt and Pepper? Things that make you go,
huh?
Hmm?
Yeah.
Probably not, but that song describes it best that you shouldn't go chasing waterfalls as well as sticking to the lakes and streams that you're used to, and don't fucking kill people. And if you do, then make sure to write a little post-it note to a lawyer to appeal after you kill yourself. And then you'll be able to go to heaven because you will be exonerated of all murders. That makes basically as much in the legal system as is opposite or here's how it should be. Let's have it entirely the other way. I would put that in that fishbowl because this makes absolutely no sense. Okay, let's make it law.
Yeah. It's just fucking crazy. It makes no sense at all, as much of this stuff does. I mean,
well, what's very disappointing and saddening is that then the family who lost a loved one. I mean, God forbid that I hopefully am never in a situation where I need to take solace or closure in somebody I love being killed and then taking comfort to know, well, at least they got the bad guy. But that makes it go away. So that then opens up that wound again that they have to live with the rest of their lives.
Yeah. Once a person is dead, I mean, what are we fighting for at that point? We're fighting for a title, you know, of murderer or not murderer. We're fighting. I mean, I get where you have estates and things of that nature that need to be settled, but doesn't that then just go to, I mean, I'm not a lawyer, but I would think that the system would say this goes to the next of kin or something like that, or gets put into trust if they're not of age or whatever it may be. What are we doing? We're digging up things like that. Okay, you know, I get when we're trying to find a person guilty or not guilty, but I mean, the case was pretty well shut and done. So I guess if you kill yourself in the process, society, I guess, has to say, if you've already been found guilty, this is shut and done, and we're assuming you were the killer because you've already been found guilty. Had you wanted to prove that you were not, then you shouldn't have killed yourself. And now, is there the possibility then that if he wasn't the killer, there's still a murderer out there on the streets? Yeah, I guess so, but there's also a gazillion other murderers out there on the streets too. So we've already gone through the process with you once. It's not like we didn't pay attention to this and attempt to determine if you were. We already determined it was so once. Why are we determining if it's so again? And I'm not saying you shouldn't have appeals or things like that, but if you kill yourself, it's kind of done. I mean, you can't say anything. You can't, you know, all of that's you. I think you kind of write your chance of getting that changed out of the equation. And obviously he was severely mentally ill, and that's what took him out, was his mental illness and driving him to kill himself. I mean, anyone who is balanced and in a good place would not do that. That's not a rational thought. Anyone who is going to make that decision is suffering with something. But what that is going to vary from person to person.
Is there any financial gain to go through an appeal process?
Other than freedom, for someone in that sort of a state, you know, other than getting back and finding a way to make a living, no. I mean, it's exorbitant attorney fees, and, you know, you'd be paying that for the rest of your life. So I don't know that there's a financial gain to it, but it would be freedom. And that's, you know, you could manage the finances of that outside of prison. But it's, you know, it's just such a, it's a sad, messed up story of someone who really did have potential, but was dealt such shit cards in terms of parents. And then, you know, just set up in life into such situations where he couldn't get, or was never encouraged to get help that was needed, and was basically told at such a young age, you're a star, you're a star, you're a star, have this, have that. And then that is not something you give to someone that's not mentally well, because this is the road that it could potentially go down. It's disastrous. People self-destruct when they're not mentally well and have resources like that and are having an ego fed from outside, from negative outside sources. It doesn't ever work out well. There's no stories of this where at the end of the day, they decided to get their shit together when they gave them all this money and all this power. And suddenly they decided that all this violence and all the things that they were naturally drawn to were just not the path they wanted. That doesn't happen. I'm sure somebody will find something, some link, and send it to me, but that typically does not happen. It's usually, that's why you have child stars where 9 out of 10 of them end up, you know, on Skid Row, because if it grows too long into teenage years and they don't get the balance in there and they don't have decent parents and people are looking out for their mental health and not their bottom line, you get kids that are messed up, some far more than others.
It is the foundation, what everything is built upon. So it's always a nice reminder when we listen to these stories of people that made some poor decisions and they're not in a good place, but they had so much. Always good to remind yourself, maybe I'm not a millionaire. Maybe I don't have this. Maybe I'm not an NFL player. Hey, but guess what I do have? I was raised in a household, or I have people in my life that taught me the importance of accountability, taught me the importance of being able to get frustrated, have a disagreement with somebody, but don't, oh, I don't know, shoot them. And all of these things you learn so that you can have that much happier of a life.
And that's,
I'm not insinuating that, well, thank goodness, all these people that I'm envious of, turns out that they're a shell of a human. It's actually quite sad. But because of that, to reassure yourself, hey, let's shift the focus of all these things that I really, really want, and that'd be really, really amazing. But guess what? Some of the things that you do have, you can't buy those. You can't buy the things you were taught and the fortunate situation that you got some pretty good people in your life that taught you from a very early age to then allow you to go out and productively take on life in a very somewhat healthy way, hopefully.
And that's the thing. You look at all that and you go, what you're talking about, the accountability, that's one of the many big building blocks of development in life. And there's all different building blocks and all different lessons and all different things that you learn and then also develop naturally in you, because they're part of you. They're part of your DNA. It's just part of survival, but they're enforced. They're reinforced in you through good parenting. And at the end of the day, you hopefully have enough building blocks there that you can keep building your life on. But the thing is, someone like Aaron Hernandez only had some of the blocks, and some of those integral ones that kept the pyramid of the blocks from falling were not there. But he kept putting weight on top of that, and top of that, and top of that, and top of that. And eventually it all crumbles down because those blocks aren't there. And at a certain point in someone's life, you look at it and he would maybe go to himself, or others would go, well, I know that he's missing that, but I don't know how the hell to fix that. I don't know how to go back and put that block there or reinforce that block that was never there. And that's where so many people, I think, fall into these things where it's just looked at as hopeless, or there's no clear path or easy path or even just direction, period, in people's lives to say, here's what we should do to try. And I know we can't rebuild that block, but I got some great wood filler over here that we can use. And hopefully we can get some semblance of a block there so it won't collapse the whole tower.
Hey, you got some mulch. You got some organic mulch. No, but I just drove by a landfill and I'm using my buddy's F-150. Shit. Make a Yui. Go pick it up. I just need some fill. It's for a rental. I don't own it. Shit. They just want to do like plants and flower beds. I don't give a shit what it is. You ain't going to see it. I mean, it'll probably, you know, sink and maybe even cause some toxicity into the soil. Fuck, I don't care. Can't see it. Just fill it.
Yeah.
It's a situation that I think leads back into the beginning of today's episode is the only person that can help right oneself is yourself. The situation you're going through, and you know that you're having these hurdles of how to try to get over. And even if there's people that want to help you, they don't know how to. And that is ultimately, in this case, what is so sad that this individual was so troubled, not giving an excuse of the actions that he chose to do, but just so much. You have a bad day, you have a bad week, you have a bad month. Obviously, for many of us, had a bad year, but you almost always go back to that reset, that control alt delete, and you wake up and you feel refreshed and you want to take on the day. For some, you get into a funk and it lasts years. Mm-hmm. And no matter what you do, you can't get out of it. And that's just a dark place, that there's no quick fix or order yourself a pizza or seven. You're just in that funk.
Yeah. And it's one of those where we're not trying to make an excuse, but it's trying to understand, you know, it's either just to say the simple response is he's crazy. You know, he's just, you know, that's the generic. Yeah. I mean, was his actions crazy? Sure. But trying to understand how someone got from point A to point B allows us to look at these things in a different light. And hopefully at some point society can look at those things in a much more mature fashion and go, these things happen a lot, and we shouldn't be skirting over them or just saying, you know, different pleasantries or just labeling thing this or that and call it that and be good. These things happen to people, and without help, these people can go very bad very quickly, but they're not unsavable until things have gone so far off the deep end in terms of them not doing these horrible actions, but all the signs are there that they're going to, but we can't do anything until after they do them. And oftentimes at that point, the damage is done. You know, even if they can mentally recover, they're incarcerated for life, and they should be if they do something that horrible. But it's like, it's the screaming flag of there's something, look here, help this. And then, oh, look, this happened. We said it was going to happen. It happened. And well, now we can react rather than preemptively do anything. It's always react. But
what it then comes down to be as simplistic as possible, do you A, live in a life of paranoia?
Mm-hmm.
Hey, this person seems totally normal and unsuspecting, but really, are they? Or yeah. To be super proactive, see, it's almost like gambling, because laws clearly are in place where, oh, so-and-so is in this state or that or the other, but they don't have a record in this, that or the other. And clearly there's laws in place to not be able to go fishing. On the flip side, to just be stagnant and lazy, for lack of a better term. Oh, there were all these signs leading up to this. Well, is there really truly then an answer of what can be done? Because if we want to be more assertive and we want to take every tip, hey, this person, blah, blah, blah. Maybe they were having a bad day. Maybe they lost their job. Maybe they just broke up with someone. I mean, you know, people are entitled to have bad days, bad weeks. So it's so increasingly difficult, almost impossible, to answer the question of should we want to change and be there for people and prevent them from doing such heinous acts. But at the same time, maybe someone's just having a bad day. And it's like, okay, easy now.
And that's,
get off my back. And that is, without being a psychic, we'll never really know which way is most effective to help the most people.
Well, it's you got to look at the long-term things. It's not just a bad day thing. It's if a doctor can look at this and go, this person has been suffering with issues for quite a while. They need help. Versus this person's having a bad day. Until our relationship in this country with mental health is remotely improved, we'll never get there because we don't handle things well. And it's very few people get the mental health help that they need or want. And some don't even understand it enough to do it because it's been so villainized in so many ways. And it's looked down upon and this and that. I mean, hell, if everybody had access and had mental health assistance, I think we'd be in a much better place in terms of our society. But that's not going to happen in our lifetime. One can only hope that maybe there's a point where some society deems that as valuable as it could, as it is, and can improve it that much more. But that's certainly nothing I think we'll ever see in our life, the value that is placed on that. Maybe we're at the beginning of going down that road. It's far less villainized than it was, you know, 10, 20, 30 years ago, but there's still such a stigma on everything with it. And until that changes to such a drastic level, you'll continue to have all sorts of things that you can look at and go, this person needed help. We could look back and go, for many, many years they needed help and they never could get it, or they didn't get it because they didn't think they needed it. And that's the problem of the not thinking it's needed and no one around them encouraging it. And then you get this. Anyway, that's going to wrap up today's episode of The Dark Side of Wikipedia, the Aaron Hernandez story. If you like the show, press subscribe wherever you download the podcast and give us a nice review there over on Apple Podcasts. We do greatly appreciate that. Until next time, for Sean and all of us at The Dark Side of Wikipedia, I'm Tony Bruschi. Thanks for listening.